The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Good afternoon. Get ready for Leadership Leverage with Dr. Robert Denker. No matter what role you play in leadership of your organization or business, you are sure to get helpful secrets that will improve that role. Now here's your host, Dr. Robert Denker.
Hello, good day, and welcome to Leadership Leverage. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Denker, and today on Leadership Leverage, we'll be exploring the topic of what makes a great boss. This is a particularly timely topic given our current economic situation, which is unfortunately still very uncertain. Much of our dialogue today will center on examining the following questions, getting some answers to these. They are, what makes a great boss? In other words, what are those key elements that contribute to a boss that's considered to be outstanding? What is the mindset a leader must have in order to have a chance to be a great boss? And if you're like many of us, the question is, how do we survive if we don't happen to work for a great boss? To help us navigate this journey today, our guest has experience addressing these and other such questions on leadership, Dr. Robert Sutton. Bob is professor of management science and engineering at Stanford University in California, an accomplished author. His book, The No Asshole Rule, was a New York Times bestseller and won a Quill Award as the best business book of the year in 2007. This fall, Dr. Sutton's newest book, Good Boss, Bad Boss, will be available from Business Plus Publications. Bob, welcome to Leadership Leverage.
Hi, Robert. It's great to be there, be here.
I'd like to start off by thinking that I'm not really an exception here. That is, I think I'm like most people who've worked in organizations, and I've had the opportunity to work in both large and small ones. I've certainly had my share of bad bosses. In preparing for the show, I think I've reported to close to a dozen separate individuals, and I can only say that perhaps two of those, I'd consider a good boss or a great boss. The rest have been really bad bosses. So given that, I think I have a good idea of what some bad bosses look like, certainly how they act. But what's a great boss in a short phrase? And why is it so hard to be a great boss?
Well, I agree with you, first of all, to start, that it is difficult to be a great boss. And if you look at the number of employees in the United States who are disengaged and will point to their immediate supervisor or boss as the main cause, that it actually turns out there are probably more bad bosses than good bosses. But it's interesting to me when you look through the empirical literature on what's a good versus a bad boss. Followers and researchers pretty much will focus on two things. One is having somebody who is competent at the position, who is good politically, good at bringing resources, good at coaching people. So competence is very important. And then the other thing is whether or not somebody treats the people who work with them in a humane and fair sort of way. So it's to me, it's competence in humanity or performance in humanity. And I think I've had bad bosses of both kinds. I once had a boss who I won't mention who was actually the sweetest, nicest, most compassionate person in the world, but really he couldn't get anything done either in terms of competence politically or in terms of the job we were trying to do.
Yeah,
and,
just wouldn't make
you,
a decision.
You really sort of need both. So that's at least my take. And by the way, everybody talks about the new management revolution and everything.
Yeah.
This definition of what a competent leader is goes way back thousands and thousands of years to pre-industrial tribes and the like. That's the person you wanted heading your tribe was somebody who was benevolent and was good at getting resources and good at getting things done. So I don't think it's really changed that much over the years.
It probably hasn't, but it seems like it's been forgotten in so many situations. And what I hear you saying in your short definition of what a good or a great boss is that the ability to manage both up and down.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that is especially striking to me in terms of managing up and down is this ability that great bosses have to sort of deal with the environment, for example, protecting employees from sort of like arbitrary rules, other lousy bosses in the organization, while at the same time sort of dealing with the performance problems, both good and bad, in the organization. So
yeah.
So that ability to manage up and down and to protect employees is something that can be very difficult. And by the way, this applies to everybody from CEOs to first-line supervisors, because in talking with CEOs recently, one of the CEOs I was talking to, he said one of his main jobs is to protect his top management team from some of his most destructive board members.
Sure.
And then, you know, recently I was talking to a supervisor who's actually like a guy who like ran shifts at a fast food restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And he said a lot of his job was to protect the hourly employees, mostly teenagers, from the idiot who owned the place.
That's
so
funny.
There's sort of this commonality in terms of what a good boss is.
First line supervisor, the manager, a director level, VP, SVP, and right up to the CEO and protecting against the board. Why is it so hard to be a great boss?
Well, to me, if you look at it, it's just the set of skills and experiences that it takes. And then there's another problem, which is that my colleague Jeff Pfeffer, who is also at Stanford, and I have written about this some, that if you have somebody who is a really competent boss,
mm-hmm.
But they're in a situation where they don't have resources, they themselves have conflicting bosses, there's conflicting goals, they don't have the power they need to do their job, you can take somebody who is perfectly competent and turn them into a lousy boss. And in fact, Jeff, my co-author, used to joke that some jobs come with a brain vacuum,
okay.
where you take a perfectly competent person and put them in the position, and then it turns them stupid. And in fact, I'm in the state of California, and my current nomination for the job that has the biggest brain vacuum is the governor of the state of California, because our governor is now Arnold Schwarzenegger, of course, and the person who he pushed out is a guy named Gray Davis, and the one thing they seem to agree on is that it's such an impossible state to govern that nobody can be competent. So there are some jobs that turn, if you will, smart people into stupid people, and I'm afraid that that's an organizational design and resource issue sometimes as well.
How much is it a power issue when people get the power, they get both hands on the key levers of the organization? How does that enter in?
Yeah, so one of the things that I talk about a lot in Good Boss, Bad Boss, and I've been studying for some years, and I have colleagues who have studied it in much more detail, is the question of what happens when you put people in positions of power.
Right.
And it's actually one of the scariest literatures I've ever seen. It turns out that...
Why is that?
When you give people just a little power over others, three things happen pretty reliably. The first thing that happens is that they start becoming focused on their own needs.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is they become more oblivious or detached from the needs of others. And the third thing is they act like the rules don't apply to them.
Oh.
So to give you just an example from one of my favorite studies done by a couple of colleagues at Stanford and the University of California at Berkeley, they had a study where they brought in a plate of cookies to three-person groups, and one of them was the boss, and the other two were the subordinates.
I've heard of this. This is excellent for our listeners. Please listen to this closely. Go ahead.
So they were sitting around sort of brainstorming about solving social problems, but one was the boss, and the other two were the underlings who were evaluated. And what happened was they brought in the plate of five cookies halfway through the experiment, allegedly.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know not to take the fifth cookie, right?
Okay, but that we were taught. Mom taught me that.
But the fourth cookie's in play, and what they did was they had three measures of the degree to which people engaged in, and I love academic language, disinhibited eating. Okay. And disinhibited eating was whether you took the fourth cookie, how many crumbs you left on your table in front of you, and whether or not you chewed with your mouth open. And it turned out, and these are people randomly assigned to conditions, that putting people in positions of power literally turned them into pigs. They ate with their mouths open, they took the fourth cookie, they left a lot more crumbs. And if you sort of go back to my three standards, one is being more focused on your own needs, two, being less focused on the needs of others, and three, acting like the rules don't apply to you. Boom, you've got power dynamics, and you've also got a pretty good explanation for some of the ridiculous behavior of people when they come into power. And to me, the interesting balance that good bosses do is they sort of fight this tendency to realize that being put in power can make them less sensitive to others. And they realize that the best bosses are sensitive, or I use the term in tune with the needs and reactions of their followers. And it's actually not an easy thing to do, to sort of battle that natural tendency towards becoming self-absorbed when all of us are put in positions of power. Although some bosses obviously fight it better than others.
Absolutely. And let's talk more about that, how you fight it and what works to become a great boss. We've got to take a commercial break. We'll be right back here on Leadership Leverage.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
Since the year 2000, our DN partners have been helping client organizations across North America and Europe achieve breakthrough performance by providing practical solutions for talent identification, talent development, and improved team performance. Our services include executive coaching and onboarding, sales selection tools validated to predict sales success, web-based pre-employment and development assessments for executive, managerial, supervisory and professional positions, talent reviews and team coaching, as well as competency modeling, including web-based custom 360 surveys. At RD and Partners, we don't arrive with ready-made solutions. Our service offerings have to fit the context of every aspect of your company, its markets, competitors, strategy, and culture. Please contact us today at rdpusa.com or by calling 888-600-7457. We look forward to helping you be successful by building and retaining your high-performance talent.
Entrepreneurial Insights is your weekly excursion into the world of business ownership. Presented by Sunbelt Business Brokers, the leading business brokerage and intermediary firm in the world, Entrepreneurial Insights will examine critical issues that impact both existing and prospective business owners. If you own or want to own a small business, listen for Entrepreneurial Insights with John Davies, Pino Bocchinello, and Matt Ottaway. Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Leadership Leverage with your host, Dr. Robert Danker. If you have a question or comment about today's program for Dr. Danker or his guests, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or if you prefer, send an email to info@rdpusa.com. Now back to Leadership Leverage.
Welcome back to Leadership Leverage. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Danker, and we've been talking today on the very timely topic of what makes a great boss. Our guest today is Robert Sutton, professor of management science and engineering at Stanford University and a New York Times best-selling author. Bob, before the commercial break, we were talking about this concept called the toxic tandem. Mm-hmm. And you were talking specifically about when people come into power, regardless of their personality, independent of that, and the power in an organization where they have their ability to let's say, even lord over others. It causes them to do three things, and I think I got these down. The first is become more focused on their own needs. The second is become less focused on the needs and wants and actions of others. And the third is really kind of an attitude, if you will, that they're not expected to follow the rules. In short, that they don't apply to them. Did I get those pretty much correct?
I think that's exactly a great summary of about 300 studies.
Yeah. And so how does one become a great boss then and guard against not doing those things when they do become in a position of power? And maybe we can take the first one.
Well, this notion I think of, and I think the first one in some ways takes care of the other two as well, which is that this notion of avoiding becoming overly inner self-directed or absorbed. And to me, there's a number of things. One of the first one, which I think probably every management expert says, or anybody who's got any common sense, which is to learn to really listen. And I think that's one of the things that great bosses do is to not pretend they're listening. I once was at a meeting with a senior executive of a large American corporation, and he talked, I would guess, 80 or 90% of the time, and this was actually a very smart group. And he leans over to me and he says, so he stopped talking. Somebody else was talking. He said to me, it may look like I'm listening, but I'm not listening. I'm just reloading. I'm trying to think of what to say next. So this is somebody who had sort of like the send only or transmit only sort of model, where he didn't really learn anything. As one of the other participants said, he just spewed out old PowerPoints that he had memorized, PowerPoint decks in his head. So the first thing is learning to listen. But the next thing, which is I think even harder for many of us, which is to encourage subordinates or to sort of argue with us or bring us bad news, is a very important thing to do, because again, there's some research, it's on the mum effect, that shows that when somebody brings us bad news, we tend to like them less. So that's one reason that subordinates are hesitant to argue with or deliver bad news to their bosses. And one of my favorite bosses, who I talk about some in the book, and we interviewed a group of us from working with the McKinsey Quarterly, interviewed him a few years back, is Brad Bird. So Brad Bird is the Academy Award-winning director of Ratatouille and The Incredibles.
That's right.
And very charming, sweet, funny guy. And his whole deal, and in fact, if you look at some of the material on The Incredibles DVD, you can see it. His whole emphasis was on making the people on his production teams feel safe to fight with him and to argue with each other over ideas. And
I think, though, Bob, that's part of the artist in him, the creativity that's part of what he does for a living.
And it is part of what he does for a living, but one thing he talked about that was quite interesting, and I really thought it was a great story, is that before he came to Pixar, he took over, sort of as a turnaround job, a messed up film called The Iron Giant that was ultimately made. It didn't do that well at the box office, but it got good reviews. And he described how he gave this whole speech to the team the first day. It was like, we will be encouraged and humiliated together, and this idea that they would argue and engage in constructive conflict. But he said they were like abused children. They just sat there and they were afraid to argue with him.
I can understand that, yeah.
And I think we can all can understand that. And the interesting thing is, he said it took about 6 weeks of working with them to get to the point where they felt safe enough to argue and disagree with him and to disagree with one another in front of him. And in a constructive way. And I sort of like that story, because it shows that you can sort of say, well, today we're going to engage in constructive conflict and I want to hear the bad news, but it takes quite a while to undo the damage if you've done it yourself or somebody else has done it.
It does. So, you have to build up that trust, and I think you do that over time. And, of course, in so many organizations, you know, we're taught, not in a formal seminar way, but we're taught through our peer group, that we're not to go to the boss with bad news.
No, we're not to go to the boss with bad news. And then the other thing that that bosses learn is, of course, is they're supposed to do most of the talking and not to actually listen. And I have to say, speaking of somebody else who I've been working with, I only met Brad Bird once, but this is somebody I've been working with for years. There's a guy named named David Kelly, who started and is now chairman of a famous innovation firm called IDEO. And David's he's a very kind of modest Midwesterner type, which actually, even though we're in California, he still has retained that after
good
all these years of living in California. And David has this incredible ability to, like, he'll go to a meeting and he'll kind of start in the front of the room and kick it off, and then as it's going well, he sort of walks to the back of the room and listens, and then he walks out. And I've teased him before that his great boss, his great skill as a boss is knowing when to get out of the way and when to leave the room. So it's like I always say, so David's engaging in management by leaving the room or walking out of the room. And it's incredibly powerful because even David, who is nice and sweet and modest a boss as you ever met, the fact that he's the CEO and it's his company, or now he's the chairman, really does stifle discussion, and he realizes that. So I think that's the kind of thing that shows the right amount of emotional sensitivity. And the other thing that David's doing there, which is another thing, this idea of being in tune with people,
right?
One of the things that that the best bosses do is they're really good at knowing when to interject and push and be assertive, and when to back off. So there's some research that that I talk about that describes how the bosses who are most effective are ones who are moderately assertive or pushy, and also know when to sort of turn it up and turn it down. And one of my favorite quotes in the process of doing the research for the book, there's the famous former L.A. Dodgers manager, Tommy Lasorda, who probably most of your listeners have heard of, although maybe not the younger ones. He's been out of the business a few years. So the first day he took over as manager of the L.A. Dodgers, he had this great line, which was that that managing is like holding a dove in your hand. If you squeeze it too tight, you kill it, and if you hold it too loosely, it flies away. And that idea of sort of like adjusting or knowing just how hard to push and to be in people's faces versus walking out is really, I think, something that takes a long time to develop. And it also takes back to this idea of focusing on the needs of others rather than the needs of yourself. It requires overcoming that toxic tandem you described, or the power poisoning, so that in realizing your effect on other people.
Well, it really seems like to me that these bosses that you've highlighted here and these great examples seem to understand that people are watching them. I mean, the spotlight is on them.
And in fact, that's a really good point, and it's related to the toxic tandem. But one of the effects of power, and by the way, this applies to animal groups as well, is that when creatures are put in position of authority, their subordinates spend a lot more time watching them than they watch their subordinates. And one of my favorite examples, there's sort of a cool literature on behavior and primate and monkey troops, and it turns out that that when you've got the alpha male baboon, that the average member of the troop looks up to see what, if you will, the boss or the alpha male is doing every 20 or 30 seconds. And being a human boss, they don't look at you that often usually, but they look at you pretty often. And this notion that you're being watched is something that I think smart bosses understand.
I would agree. They have to, because it is the differentiator between what a good or great boss is and what one that is not. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. And it is interesting, because I don't like to be overly Pollyannish, that there are some bosses who are very good at sort of doing the financial aspects and doing things that will make them lots of money but are despised by their subordinates.
Mm-hmm.
Because they treat them so badly, and it is possible to be financially successful, but I would argue that at least in the long term, and there's growing evidence to support this, that although you have people like George Steinbrenner or sometimes Steve Jobs, although Steve Jobs has actually gotten much better in his old age, who have histories of being abusive to their subordinates, that people like that, they would do even better if they were more civilized. And then the other problem with being a jerky, sort of nasty but competent boss is that once you start having performance problems, you get pushed out the door very quickly. And a good example of that, which everybody seems to have forgotten in U.S. industry, is that Steve Jobs actually got fired by the board probably now about 15 years ago, the first time when he was involved in starting the companies, for two reasons. One is that his jerkiness was completely out of control. And then the second reason was that Apple was having a little bit of performance problems with the Macintosh. So between the two of those things, he ended up being shoved out the door. And another example is Michael Eisner, who was a CEO of Disney, which was that he kept becoming jerkier and creating more and more enemies. But as long as they were doing well, the board sort of put up with him or didn't have the power to push him out. Mm-hmm. But as soon as he they got into financial problems or a little bit, they got rid of him very quickly. And that's what I always say about jerk or asshole bosses is that if you're doing well and bringing in the money, you better keep it up because you're going to get shown the door very quickly if you start having even a hint of performance problems.
So no leeway at all to those people.
Well, they have less leeway. On the other hand, you know, I guess that a cynic might say that that you can get away with being a lousier boss if you're a nicer person, which probably actually might be true. So I guess a cynic could always turn anything around.
We need to take a commercial break here.
Right.
And when we come back, I want to talk more about this aspect of being a great boss, and in particular during these times of economic uncertainty, because it causes a certain pressure on all leaders. So let's do that. We'll be right back here on Leadership Leverage.
Thanks, Robert.
Always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
Get ready for Straight Talk Live with Tanya Walker. From the worlds of business, entertainment, health, and politics, enjoy intimate interviews and spirited roundtable discussions with Tanya's guest experts and friends. Tanya may be best known for her Emmy-nominated role as Alex from ABC TV's One Life to Live, but she's also an award-winning film and Broadway producer with a passion for straight, honest journalism. So don't miss Straight Talk Live with Tanya Walker, Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific, on the Voice America Business Channel.
Since the year 2000, RDN Partners have been helping client organizations across North America and Europe achieve breakthrough performance by providing practical solutions for talent identification, talent development, and improved team performance. Our services include executive coaching and onboarding, sales selection tools, validated to predict sales success, web-based pre-employment and development assessments for executive, managerial, supervisory and professional positions, talent reviews and team coaching, as well as competency modeling, including web-based custom 360 surveys. At RDN Partners, we don't arrive with ready-made solutions. Our service offerings have to fit the context of every aspect of your company, its markets, competitors, strategy, and culture. Please contact us today at rdpusa.com or by calling 888-600-7457. We look forward to helping you be successful by building and retaining your high-performance talent.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Listening to Leadership Leverage with your host, Dr. Robert Danker. If you have a question or comment about today's program for Dr. Danker or his guests, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or if you prefer, send an email to info@rdpusa.com. Now back to Leadership Leverage.
Welcome back to Leadership Leverage. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Danker, and today we're talking on the topic of what makes a great boss. Our guest is Robert Sutton, professor of management science and engineering at Stanford University. and a New York Times best-selling author who wrote the book The No Asshole Rule that was awarded the Quill Award as the best business book for the year 2007. And important to note, too, that this fall, Dr. Sutton's newest book, Good Boss, Bad Boss, will be available from Business Plus Publications. Now, Bob, before we went on break, we were talking about, and you were giving wonderful examples of some leaders that most of us know that are popular in industry, that have a certain cachet about them, and that when things turn bad, you know, they were asked to leave the company quite quickly. There wasn't
right.
a lot of leeway. So given the economic times that we're in, and I'm still going to label them uncertain, under pressure for margins because many organizations are not growing on the revenue side, isn't it hard to for even a good boss to not fall into these traps?
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the things that I actually argue in the new chapter. It's actually called About Boss Holes, and is that if you were going to design a job to turn people into jerks, a management or boss position is a pretty good position because, as
we
discussed,
talk to us about that. Yeah.
You give people power, you put them under pressure, you work them so hard they're sleep deprived and exhausted. They're constantly being asked to explain their behavior and the behavior of their firms or groups. Being a leader is especially difficult, and when you're doing things where you're worried about hurting others, then it actually can lead people to be even worse. So I you know, it's one thing that, as I always joke, I study management, but I think it's really a hard thing to do and to learn to do well. But I mean, to your question about the tough times, and we were talking about this a little bit in between the commercial.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the, like the clients I work with, the executives I teach, and just the people who just write me on my blog and the like too. It's really been a tough last couple of years where people have had to do layoffs and pay cuts, and the fact is that when you look at what it takes to be a good boss, to me there's two sort of characteristics. One is that you sort of got the guts and the skill to make and implement the hard decisions because, I mean, if you think about those companies, if they hadn't done cost cutting, things would be even worse. I mean,
that's right.
So very often it has to be done. And then the other part about it is there's a difference between what you do and how you do it. And one thing that I've written about and studied for years is the notion of, well, how do you sort of implement a bad or a tough decision in a way that does less harm? And so I've got four sort of guidelines. One is prediction, the second one's understanding, the third one's control, and the fourth one is compassion. So just maybe the best way to explain these is we were discussing Procter and Gamble a while ago. In 2000, I did a little 2-hour session with the top management team of Procter and Gamble. This was when A.G. Lafley first took over, and in fact, a guy named John Pepper was still chairman at the time. And I was discussing prediction, understanding, control, and compassion. And John Pepper, who had been CEO and is actually now chairman, the board chair at Disney, he was describing how they changed the way they shut plants at Procter and Gamble to sort of follow those guidelines. Where what they would do in the past when they closed a plant, they used to sort of shut the plant and get out of town as quickly as possible.
Oh, okay.
But they learned that when they announce it well in advance, explain to the community and to the employees in as much detail as possible why it's happening, find ways to give employees and even members of the community control for example, to choose like job training
mm-hmm.
or different amounts of cash or to try to generate some new job options for them, and to say they're sorry and to express human compassion. He said the thing that we discovered that was really interesting was, first of all, we had fewer lawsuits, but the thing that really surprised them was that they used to have a lot of trouble where they close a plant in a community and Procter & Gamble sales would go down in the community because they were mad at them.
Oh, absolutely, sure.
So he said that we noticed that when we did a closing with prediction, understanding, control, and compassion, that that negative effect of leaving a community would go away or be attenuated. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And in talking to my friends who unfortunately were involved in both sides of this process, those who either did it in a compassionate and effective way or not, it had a big effect on especially the people who remained in the company, whether or not they were bitter or waiting for the next shoe to fall and the like. So it is interesting that, as one of my friends, Michael Deering's a former eBay executive, always argues, there's a difference between what you do and how you do it. And I think sometimes, although executives know that intellectually and bosses know that intellectually, sometimes when they're under fire, they forget that. And I think we all do when we're under pressure.
So how does a person who wants to be a great boss begin this journey? Let's talk about predictability. What are some of the salient issues there?
In terms of predictability, I'm thinking of things like layoffs and pay cuts or moving headquarters, all different things that I've been involved in as a consultant or somebody who's been, the victim of it myself.
Right. Major change is what you're talking about.
It is possible usually to give people a schedule to figure out when things are going to be happen, as opposed to just sort of like dropping surprise bombs on them as much as possible. So a sense of what's coming. And then the other thing, and this is one thing that I learned with some layoffs, that this is a long time ago when I was doing like my dissertation research in Michigan, is that even telling people something like, well, we don't know whether the plant is going to close or not, but we can assure you that it won't be closing for at least, or that we won't make any decision for at least 60 days.
Okay.
And so what that does is it gives them this sort of period of psychological safety, that they don't go to work every day waiting for the bad news to sort of fall.
On one hand, you have to be careful not to overpromise, right?
No, you can't. Once you overpromise, you're dead because they think you're a liar and you're full of it and everything. Actually, as we've seen with BP, I think that I guess that they really have stopped the leakage, and all of us are starting to believe that. But I think at first, many of us didn't quite believe it because they kept being overly optimistic. So you got to be very careful with that. That's a great point.
So that's part of predictability, not to overpromise, but give people a period or a window of stability in terms of, you know, maybe the parameters of what's not going to happen now, but it may happen in the future. Well, what about understanding?
Well, to me, understanding is to give people enough information about why the tough decision, for example, was necessary. So, back to the Procter & Gamble case, they've learned to sort of give more and more information about why there's some kind of a business case to do that. I also talk about some closings that Intel has been doing in Oregon, and although the employees aren't wild about it, the people who are implementing it, the executives, are doing actually a very good job of giving an enormous amount of information about, from why a business perspective, that they're ending some of the product lines there. So that would be an example of understanding. And then for control, to me, it's simply finding as many ways as possible to have people sort of control how they leave, as opposed to having the security guard show up and throw them out the door.
Yeah.
And providing them with no advance notice, to the extent that people have choices about ways that the money that's spent on them for layoff and the like, they have some control over what actually happens to them.
So that may be a case if they're offered some outplacement service, they can either choose it or maybe take a certain amount of money in lieu of. That would be an example of having some element of control.
And even having control over, you know, something like if you in the next couple of weeks you can leave and you have control over what maybe a few things that you take and things like that, not steal but take. So,
right.
So I think that's some of the ways that I've seen it. I mean, another thing on control that I always thought was interesting is, I think I've written one of the only academic papers on funerals for dying organizations.
Oh, really?
Yes, I don't know how, one of those strange things I got involved in. And I think that's one of the way, and they're very common when a bank branch closes or a plant closes, there's nearly always some sort of goodbye party. And I do think that in addition to the emotional part and having a sense of closure, that those sort of ceremonies, a little bit like funerals, make people feel like they have some sense of control of the way that the process sort of unfolds, in addition to all the emotional parts.
I think you're really spot on, because that closure is really an important aspect of these types of upheavals that we're talking about. Can we go back to understanding just for a minute? Because I
sure.
want your perspective. You know, you were talking about explain why the changes are happening. It seems to me, in the experiences that I had, the leadership at the time talks specifically about the what. You know, what's going to happen, the schedule, but it's never really about the why, what led the decisions. Why is that forgotten?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is sometimes I just don't know and they're just guessing. I mean, to be cynical, but I also think that sometimes that there's this sense that, and sometimes the legalistic mentality gets in the way of this too, that they're sort of afraid to explain the sort of logic of the business. And I actually think that it helps people accept what's going on. Oh, sounds like we're going to break.
Oh, we are. You caught that before I did, so thank you. Well, we're going to take a commercial break. We have to pay our sponsors. We're here on Leadership Leverage today, talking with our guest, Robert Sutton, about what it takes to be a great boss. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network. Are you ready to grow your business? Listen for the Independent Business Owner Show with your coach, Rick Corrado. This entertaining talk radio program will bring you the tools to help increase your business. You'll learn sales success, time management, lead generation, business development, life balance, and much more. Rick Corrado is here to help you take your business to the next level. Listen for the Independent Business Owner Show, heard live every Monday morning at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Network.
Since the year 2000, RD and Partners have been helping client organizations across North America and Europe achieve breakthrough performance by providing practical solutions for talent identification, talent development, and improved team performance. Our services include executive coaching and onboarding, sales selection tools validated to predict sales success, web-based pre-employment and development assessments for executive, managerial, supervisory, and professional positions, talent reviews and team coaching, as well as competency modeling, including web-based custom 360 surveys. At RD & Partners, we don't arrive with ready-made solutions. Our service offerings have to fit the context of every aspect of your company, its markets, competitors, strategy, and culture. Please contact us today at rdpusa.com or by calling 888-600-7457. We look forward to helping you be successful by building and retaining your high-performance talent.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Listening to Leadership Leverage with your host, Dr. Robert Danker. If you have a question or comment about today's program for Dr. Danker or his guests, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or if you prefer, send an email to info@rdpusa.com. Now back to Leadership Leverage.
Welcome back to Leadership Leverage. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Danker, and today we've been having a very lively dialogue on the topic, What Makes a Great Boss? Our guest today is Robert Sutton, Professor of Management Science and Engineering at Stanford University. Bob has a new book coming out this fall entitled Good Boss, Bad Boss, and it will be available from Business Plus Publications. Bob, before we went on a break, we were talking about during these tough economic times how individual bosses can guard against becoming a bad boss. And you were talking about really four aspects. We talked about the first three, predictability, understanding, the third being control. Let's talk briefly about the fourth one, compassion.
Well, to me, compassion is simply the notion of having enough empathy, and in some ways it's almost like manners, and this all gets to me to this ability to be able to see the other person's perspective, to make them feel as if they've been treated like with dignity in the process. And
is this similar to emotional intelligence we hear about?
Yeah, I think it does. Well, emotional intelligence is like this very broad sort of concept. But yeah, I think it does get to emotional intelligence. But it is interesting that even people I know who seem to be remarkably socially inept can develop this ability, which is to simply do simple things like not hurry people. It's amazing how some people don't take the time to say thank you, and so acting sort of curt, not looking people in the eye. There's a lot of sort of simple, basic sort of human things that can be very powerful, that enable people to feel as if they're being treated with some human compassion. And it is interesting that that compassion or empathy or whatever kind of term in that area you want to use.
Well, let's call it dignity and respect, I think.
Dignity and respect. Is it even when you give people good news, or but you treat them with disrespect in the process, they often have very negative reactions. And to me, that's part of the process of learning to be a good boss, which is, I guess, learning to be a good and effective, influential human being as well. And it is interesting. I mean, there's some research that's been done on how hurried we all are, and I mean, there's a number of sort of good surveys that show that people are reporting that they don't have time to stop and be courteous or civilized and nice. And you know, and it might be we are putting people in that situation, but it's a shame if we are.
I would agree, and part of that, you know, you see every day people on cell phones constantly in the cars the minute they get off the airplane, or actually even before it gets to the gateway,
right.
You know.
pretty scary, although I do that sometimes too, so I'm pleading guilty.
Well, I do too, but you know, it's part of the learned behavior that we all do. So, to be a good boss, I think there has to be some really wisdom here that you're talking about. What is the wisdom?
So wisdom is something, actually my colleague Jeff Pfeffer and I have been writing about wisdom for some years, and one of the things that really struck us is that, I mean, there's an interesting set of studies and also lots of cases that show that we all actually want a confident boss who acts like they're in control. George Washington is sort of exhibit one. That was one of the great things that he was able to do, is he looked like he was in control. He was on that white horse, and he was confident, and also the tallest guy in the room, of course. But all that sort of confidence stuff helps. But if you've just got confidence but you have no humility, you're in trouble. And what the best bosses do is that they tend to have the confidence and the humility together. So they have the courage to act on the knowledge they have right now. But when it turns out that things aren't turning out so well, that they hear the bad news, they see the bad news, and they sort of, as Andy Grove put it, they sort of clean things up and learn and move on. And that balance between courage and humility and the ability to act but doubt your actions is this sort of magical thing, I think, that the best leaders and best bosses that at least I've seen in actions have. And it's a rare thing, but it does happen sometimes. I already mentioned A.G. Lafley is a good example of this. There's another guy I know is a senior guy from McKinsey, Lenny Mendonca, who, not all management consultants are modest, he always impresses me with his ability to both be confident while at the same time to listen and move forward. And it's an impressive thing when you see it.
Bob, can these characteristics or competencies be learned?
Oh yeah, so I you know, this notion of are leaders born or made? I think that the evidence largely is that it's a matter of experience. And if I think of the two companies I know best that have produced lots of leaders. One is the old Hewlett-Packard, and the other one is sort of the General Electric, which is very committed to developing leaders. And in that case, what they do, both companies, not HP so much anymore, they sort of start out by giving people one subordinate and see how they do and have them learn it, and they sort of move their way up the chain till eventually, in the old days at HP, somebody like Lou Platt would become CEO, and now General Electric's very good at doing that sort of thing. So yes, people can learn it, and I guess that the best advice I would give is that try to find a good mentor and watch them closely, because I think that's one of the main ways that you learn to be a good boss, is to watch somebody good in action. The company, by the way, that
I... Well, and I think on that mentorship, too, that may be someone who's not in your organization.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it's interesting that the number of CEOs I know now who have turned to coaches or turned out to be very important. And there's an interesting guy. He's got a little executive experience. He was CEO of Intuit, for example. But there's a guy named... Bill Campbell in Silicon Valley, who has been mentor to everybody from Steve Jobs to the Google team.
That's right.
Dozens of folks, and it's funny because his job before he got into tech is he was the coach of the Columbia football team, so they call him the coach. And I think the number of the amount of value that that Bill Campbell has created by being a great role model and a very wise mentor in the Silicon Valley is absolutely stunning. So and everybody I know who's ever worked for Bill is loyal to him for their entire life. Even the group of people who went through like an organizational death with him, because he handled it back to prediction, understanding, control, and compassion with so much grace and caring that he's one of the most well-loved people in the Valley.
So the key lesson then for those that are emerging leaders in organizations, you know, younger in their career, is go out and find that example, go out and find that mentor, and if it's not in your organization, look outwardly.
And then I would also add, for people who are sort of setting up systems that in organizations and setting up career training, that part of your job is to find those people inside or outside of your organization and to assign them to the future leaders that you want to develop. So to me, that's something you can do as a boss, but it's also for people in senior management and executive development and the like, that that's something that can be actually approached fairly systematically in some cases.
I think that's excellent advice, because if one thing we are as humans, we're learning machines, and we learn through imitation. So get a good leader to imitate, right?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Bob, our time is up. I've certainly enjoyed having you on the program today. I wish you all the best success with your new book that's coming out this fall called Good Boss, Bad Boss, available from Business Plus Publications. Again, to all of our listeners, I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Well, thank you, Robert. It's been wonderful, and I've enjoyed talking to you a great deal.
Excellent. Next week on Leadership Leverage, we'll be having a lively discussion on how to lead your business to ensure success. Our guest will be Rick Corrado. Rick has trained over 3,000 independent business owners in the last 16 years and launched over 30 businesses. He currently oversees a dozen of them. So join me next Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time right here on Voice America Business. Thank you for being part of Leadership Leverage. Until next time, this is Dr. Robert Dinker, and the doctor is out.
Thank you again for tuning in to Leadership Leverage this afternoon. Please tune in again next Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern Time for another edition of Leadership Leverage with Dr. Robert Dinker on the Voice America Business Channel.